the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, me Martinez. You might have questions about how the president's positive COVID test may affect the presidential campaign. We have answers that'll keep you informed all the way up to Election Day. Plus, now that Governor Newsom has put pen to paper turning bills into laws, we'll hear how some might change the way we live in California. It's all coming up on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take 2. I'm E. Martinez. Thanks for joining us this Friday. Coming up.
We were at a point with them where they said, here it is. We have this much inventory left in all of the U.S., and it's at our stores. You want it or not?
That was the exchange between Apple and Los Angeles Unified Superintendent Austin Buettner back in March as a district scrambled to get ready for school in a pandemic. Well, he was given the power to say yes to that and a lot more. We'll talk about that just ahead. But we'll start with State of Affairs, our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. Governor Gavin Newsom had a big stack of bills on his desk, all waiting to find out if he'd sign and turn them into laws. We're going to take a dive into which ones got ink and which ones stayed blank. Plus, President Trump has had quite a roller coaster of a week. Joining us for State of Affairs is Carla Marinucci, Politico's California Playbook senior writer, and Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Now, we got to start with the top news from last night. President Trump tweeted that he and the First Lady tested positive for coronavirus. The only update that I've seen in the last few minutes is that the president has been dealing with a fever since the morning, which lines up with what the White House has described as mild symptoms. Now, even though it's not California specific, there are lots of questions flying around. Rafe, for starters, though, the couple is reportedly showing these symptoms. What happens if, in the next few weeks, the president becomes too sick to perform his duties as president? Does the vice president just simply step in?
Well, if it's a temporary incapacity, then the president can step aside for a while and Vice President Pence could act as president. The bigger question is if he were to, in the unlikely event, to withdraw from the race or, God forbid, to die from the illness, in the most unlikely and saddest circumstance, the Republican National Committee would convene to select a new nominee whose name would be too late to go on the ballot, but would undoubtedly be Vice President Pence because it's possible Vice President Pence could have succeeded to the presidency through that process.
So a vote for Trump would then be a vote for Pence in that case. Would that be an easy substitution?
It's not a certainty because electors are sometimes pledged to vote for the candidate who won in the state, regardless of whether the candidate can still take office. But my guess is every Republican elector would vote for Pence and then take whatever small consequences there are in their particular state. But yes, that would be most likely what would happen.
What about in the case of Joe Biden, in case something like that happens with him? What happens to him, or at least what happens to the Democratic side of the ticket on Election Day?
It's exactly the same thing. The Democratic National Committee would convene and make a choice. Of course, being Democrats, there's no telling how many different ways the electors might go. But they're not quite as disciplined as Republicans. But I would imagine they would support whoever the Democratic National Committee selected.
Okay. Carla, it's a real concern because we saw what happened with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. He's now recovered, but he was in intensive care after contracting the virus. So what's been the reaction today, Carla, from both sides of the aisle on what we saw last night?
Well, you know, Vice President Joe Biden was just on air saying he's had two coronavirus tests even today. He has sent out messages of empathy, and I think many Democratic leaders have. There's a lot of concern on both sides of the aisle. I think the concern is, where does the discussion go? Where does the campaign go at this point when you're 32 days out from the election with people already voting? We know the playbooks have got to be thrown out, but major things with regard to even the next debate, even the operations of government, even the Senate confirmation hearings. We're hearing some of those senators, including Mike Lee of Utah, have tested positive. So on many different levels, it's still being sort of discussed. just how deep the impact goes on government and on the election that is just around the corner.
So, Carla, I mean, we really are in a scenario where we have no idea how things might shake out even tomorrow or even later this afternoon.
No, absolutely. I mean, this for the Trump campaign, look, this is a campaign that has defined itself on big in-person rallies, often in defiance of public health officials. And Donald Trump was expected to come to Los Angeles and Orange County next Tuesday for fundraising. Those are off, obviously. But, I mean, right now, it's all about the messaging as well. Remember that Trump kind of did everything in his power to shift the focus away from the handling of the coronavirus, and he wanted to talk about economy and law and order, and basically also always gave an upside on the COVID crisis with regard to vaccine development. So that campaign playbook is thrown out the window, and the infection now ensures that the final month of the campaign, it's going to bring his record front and center on this treatment, on the seriousness of the virus and that whole discussion. And I think the Biden campaign is to be very, very careful, to be respectful of this illness and the virus and its effects on President Trump. But at the same time, they're going to have to determine how this next debate is going to come off and how his campaign events are also going to come off, because it's almost a switch in roles, Trump is going to be in the basement, so to speak, and Biden's going to be out on the campaign trail.
All right, so getting back to California, we passed the finish line for Governor Gavin Newsom to sign or veto the bills passed by the state legislature. We did a round robin on them earlier this week, but one we have not dug into yet is AB 1185. This one is now law. It would give county officials more oversight on sheriff departments. Rafe, you wrote an opinion in Cal Matters urging Newsom to sign it. Tell us more about how this would work.
I think this is a real sleeper of this entire session. It got very little coverage, but I've had my eye on it from the start. This breaks into the question of oversight of county sheriffs by elected county supervisors, 58 boards of supervisors in the state. And this would allow and authorize any county's board of supervisors to create an inspector general and or a civilian oversight commission and to grant them subpoena authority over the sheriffs and the sheriff department. And while most counties won't use it, one has been using it for 30 years, San Diego, and LA and Sacramento are in major conflicts between supervisor boards and their sheriffs. And this will be the first time the state of California has really seriously weighed in on helping counties hold their law enforcement officials accountable. Most of our years have been spent working at the city level with police chiefs and police departments. This is a whole new frontier, and I consider this extraordinarily significant.
Well, you mentioned L.A. County, Rafe, and that's where Sheriff Alex Villanueva and the L.A. County Board of Supervisors have had a very public spat going on for a while now. Villanueva has said that the state attorney general is the only person he answers to. So what could maybe a beefed-up civilian oversight committee require a sheriff such as Villanueva to do that maybe he may not want to do?
Well, first of all, that's not correct that only the attorney general has that authority. The county charter, as all county charters do, or most, would give the county supervisors the ability to supervise all county officials. His main complaint is the subpoena authority, which the county supervisors, with 72% of the voters joining in March, granted to a civilian oversight commission. I think
that was Measure R.
Measure R. Yeah. And that's the issue that this law addresses. And I don't believe now that the sheriff has any legal grounds except to contest a particular subpoena and say it interferes with his investigative authority. Beyond that, I think this knocks the last legal pillar out of the saying that he can only do, what as he put it, the supervisors and the inspector general can ask, please, to get information. That's not what a subpoena is.
Now, Carla, the governor also passed other laws that would force police reforms throughout the state. But in the midst of this national movement on reform, are these game changers? Are they shaping up that way? Why or why not?
Well, you know, many civil liberties groups were pushing hard for some landmark moves. I think they felt like they got some modest reforms that might have fell short of that game changer label A. I mean, one of the new laws was directly in response to the killing of George Floyd that was signed by Newsom, AB 1196, that bans officers from using that cardioid sleeper restraint, that neck hold that has gotten so much attention because it's a killer when it's applied improperly. So I think that was a key one. Many departments had already prohibited that. Another law, AB 1506 by Assemblymember Kevin McCarty, it was probably the biggest breakthrough, I think, for advocates wanting a change. That requires the Attorney General rather than local authorities to conduct investigations into certain deadly police shootings of unarmed civilians. And that was a key, seen as a key to improve public trust of these investigations. I think it was a disappointment to some of these groups that some of the more aggressive proposals stalled in the legislature, including one that would have established a system for decertifying police officers who've committed serious offenses on the job, because California remains only one of five states that don't have a process for pulling an officer's badge if they've committed a crime. So mixed bag a little bit. I think there were some game changers and some disappointments.
Staying on reform for a second, the LA Times decided to do the numbers on where the money is flowing from in the LADA race. That's between incumbent Jackie Lacey and challenger George Gascon. Carla, what story do the numbers tell us?
Well, wow, they tell us that Jackie Lacey, the incumbent, and a high-profile black woman holding a major law enforcement spot in America, I mean, is facing the political fight of her life to retain this spot as LADA, even though she's been a fixture in LA politics for more than a decade. And, you know, with police reforms front and center this year, the ideological race could not be clearer on the money. I mean, it has attracted $12 million in donations this race. Her opponent, George Gascon, who is, of course, the former police chief and DA of San Francisco, has raised $6.6 million, and he's outraised Lacey by about $800,000. And what we're seeing is he's getting this lion's share of big money from very wealthy progressives from the Bay Area. There are people like Reed Hastings, the Netflix CEO, and his wife. They put in almost $2 million, and George Soros has put in $1.5 million. You know, a few days later, Lacey got $1 million from a pair of police unions. They've given her about 75% of her donations, including the San Francisco Police Officers Association, which has no big love for George Gascon. Yeah. So this has been a fight between two Democrats, very contentious and very expensive.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Yeah, two Democrats fighting in this fight, and a clear example of an ideological divide in this elected official race between two people of the same political party. Now, we heard police and criminal justice reform advocates say they were trying to ride the momentum that was sparked by the killing of George Floyd to get as much through to Gavin Newsom's desk as possible. Rafe, I want to ask, why does reform of any kind tend to need an emotional boost that always seems to have a very small window of time for action? I mean, if most people agree that, say, for example, LA needs police reform, why wouldn't the spirit of the intention stay strong?
Because reform is an incredibly difficult marathon, and a movement gives it a lot of energy. And the question is how to harness that energy to get reform. Because as soon as you start applying the movement idea, you open the door to tons of new ideas. There's not one of these ideas that the governor was looking at that would have even been under consideration without the movement for reform. But then once you get moving on reform, you find there's a lot of institutional obstacles that have had 20, 30, 40 years to entrench themselves. And you have to go one at a time and confront them, change them, challenge them, persuade them, while still maintaining that movement energy. Every little victory you get gives a sense of spirit, and you don't want your folks to get demoralized in a movement. But that's how change happens. It's a marathon with sprints in between, driven by movements.
Now, this might come off as a little jaded, but I got to think that most official business for most elected officials has a very well thought out plan down to timing of everything. Now, this is for both of you. I'm wondering if we can glean anything from Gavin Newsom leaving these police reform bills to the very few last hours to sign. Rafe, anything to that?
I don't know, because I was sitting there waiting to hear what was going to happen to 1185.
Okay.
I think there may be a sense that there were a number of other things he wanted to have attention for, that he knew these would be both make some people happy and disappoint many people. I don't know if it was that carefully thought out, but none of the bill signings attracted vast attention because there's just such a mass of them. But maybe there's a little bit of that going on.
Carla, what about you? You've been reporting on all these politicians for years.
I think it's been a chaotic year, more than chaotic. You had some folks up in Sacramento, both on the Assembly and the Senate, contract COVID. The session was delayed for a few weeks. I mean, under all those circumstances, I think everything went by the wayside, and a lot of it just piled up at the end.
Now, Carla, Governor Newsom did veto a bill that would have affected hotels and businesses in the hospitality industry. The bill said that if they laid off workers because of the pandemic, then they should be first in line when the businesses need to rehire again. Newsom axed it, however, saying that it's too broad. The state Chamber of Commerce called it a job killer. What kind of political pressure is Gavin Newsom now facing for the economic fallout from this long lockout our state has had to endure?
Yeah, I mean, this bill is an example of how Newsom has been between a rock and a hard place on COVID and the business community for months now. I mean, in this case, I mean, obviously the labor groups really pushed it, saying that people needed to get back to work. But then the hospitality industry was saying, look, it's going to just kill the business entirely. And this has been, whether you talk about restaurants or theaters, nail salons or gyms, you've got a lot of the same issues that Newsom has faced, where and when to draw the line, how to protect Californians on COVID, and how to protect businesses. And he is still trying to navigate that as we speak. And it has not been easy. There doesn't look to be any easy fix on a lot of these. And this is one where another bill where he took heat for vetoing, but at the same time said he had to protect the business and the industry first. And that was his main consideration there.
Now, looking at the 2 years that Newsom has had as governor, what would you both rank as some of the biggest or most game-changing bills he has signed into law? Rafe, let's start with you.
Well, I don't know that I would look at bills themselves, but I would say last year and this year look very, very different, because last year was fun for the governor. I mean, there was money in the bank, there were no major crises, and he was able to sign bills in health care and in wildfire protection, and to make a signal that he was going to be more generous than Jerry Brown, more money for higher education. Now, that's what a new governor would love to do. The bills this year are overshadowed by the crisis, the overlapping crises. I think what writes the story of this year is how the governor handles the coronavirus, the wildfire. That is so much more in the public mind than, in a sense, bills that are more of interest to the insiders and the active groups. I don't know if Carla feels the same way, but I think this is the year of managing crisis, and last year was the year of just glorious legislation from his standpoint.
Carla, what do you think?
I think there were some bills in the last 2 years that really put California on the map. Obviously, AB 5, that was the sweeping labor classification law, ride sharing, and so forth. I mean, it's now the subject of a ballot measure, Prop 22, whether you should classify contract workers as employees. The bill that was just signed to add diversity to California corporate boards, I think that one's getting national attention. A ban on flavored tobacco, that bill to cap rent increases and limit evictions, huge during the COVID crisis, and the family leave expansion, I think, was big. On executive orders, halting the executions, dismantling death row, I think, was a landmark measure. And then phasing out the sale of electric cars and trucks by 2035, another thing that has gotten national attention.
All right, and just breaking news now. President Trump is headed to Walter Reed Medical Center. He's had a fever since this morning, so we've got word now that the president is headed to Walter Reed Medical Center. We'll have more details as this unfolds. Carla Marinucci, Politico's California Playbook senior writer, and Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. Carla, Rafe, thank you very much.
Good to be with
Thanks
you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, once again, as we just heard, President Trump is headed to Walter Reed Hospital following his COVID-19 diagnosis. He's been dealing with a fever since the morning, and we'll have more on this story as it continues to break here on 89.3 KPCC. More Take 2 coming right up. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm A. Martinez. As we just heard, President Trump is headed to Walter Reed Medical Center. Associated Press is reporting this. He has had a fever since this morning, so he is on his way to Walter Reed Medical Center. We'll have more on this as it continues to unfold. Wednesday night, Los Angeles sports fans had a unique but fun choice to make. You see, for the first time, the Lakers and Dodgers were playing playoff games at the same exact time. Yeah, it's never happened before, and you can thank the pandemic for that. A night like that would have been a perfect opportunity to run to a packed sports bar and enjoy the energy of a few hundred people watching both teams play. But that's not happening. And again, you can thank the pandemic for that. Steve Cohen is owner of West Hills Pizza Company in the San Fernando Valley, and he imagined what it would have looked like and felt like in his bar if he was allowed to be open at full capacity.
I would have 300 people trying to get into a place that seats 150. We've been, because the Lakers haven't been in the playoffs the last 6 years, World Series and playoff time for Dodgers were packed. And if you would have thrown the Laker playoffs on top of that, it'd be a madhouse. It'd be the funnest place to be in West Hills.
Okay, now what's the situation for a West Hills Pizza Company?
I do have a patio, and I have five tables out there. I could put 30 people. And I have one TV outside. I should mention I have 11 TVs inside. So, I can only show one game outside. Normally, on Sundays, we have the Sunday ticket. We don't have that this year because I can't put people in the restaurant. But most of my customers are understanding. Most of my customers understand what's going on. But I could put 30 people at the most on my patio.
Wow. So, I mean, aside from the lack of income, which I know is probably the most important thing, Steve, for you and West Hills Pizza Company, being at a sports bar is just full of energy. That's why people go. They want to hang out with other people that think like them, that like the same teams. That is not obviously there with the decrease in capacity. I mean, how does it feel on those nights where you do get your 30 people in there? Is it just not as good as it could have been?
No, the energy is not there. I was listening to Anthony Davis yesterday talk about that very same thing about does he feel the energy of the finals? And he says, well, the logo's on the court. So, the energy just isn't there. But I try not, I'm a huge Laker fan like most, so I try not to let that deter me. But, it's what it is, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, considering you mentioned how you're a big Laker fan, the last time the Lakers were in this position in the NBA Finals, that was against the Boston Celtics. And if anybody knows anything about the Lakers' history, you know that the biggest enemy they have in the world are the Boston Celtics. So, I mean, did you have the bar back then in 2010? And if you did, I mean, what was it like back then to have that kind of experience in a full-packed bar?
Wasn't our busiest night, but the night that they clawed back and beat the Celtics in Game 7 was the best night in the restaurant ever. Just energy-wise. I'm sure you, like most, remember the game. It was like pulling teeth. Nobody can make a shot. And, after Artest hit his three-pointer, you could just feel everybody's emotions just spilling out. And it was just the best.
Hey, Steve, take us back for a second to that time. It was mid-March when we all found out that a lot of things were starting to shut down. There was an NBA basketball game that was postponed, ultimately canceled right at the last second when a player on the Utah Jazz tested positive for COVID. And it was a weird time because we didn't know anything about COVID. We weren't sure about anything. Tom Hanks and his wife, Rita Wilson, announced they're positive. What did you think at the time? I mean, I'm sure the bar was open and you guys had customers, but what was going on in your mind at that time? Were you thinking, well, okay, this is temporary and we'll soon get back to normal?
I believe on March 22nd, we shut down without really knowing, because back then, you're trying to stay away from this invisible threat that nobody can physically see. We shut down and I was shut down for a week. And then after a week, I realized that we need to reopen. We need to stay relevant in the community. And fortunately, my crew is the best and we had a meeting and they all wanted to work. Then we were able to reopen. And we reopened about 25% capacity, and then 2 weeks after that, we were told to shut down again. So it's a roller coaster.
I know. Yeah, I was doing post game Lakers at that time for the Lakers flagship station. I remember that night very well. Steve, one more thing. You know, for people that aren't sports fans, that don't have sports in their life, sometimes they have trouble understanding why not having sports is such a blow to a sports fan's soul, to a sports fan's heart. If you could give us just one thing out of your mind that you've experienced in the absence of having a sports bar open, that communal feeling as you talked about, to explain to people like why this means so much, to be able to one day maybe look forward to having your bar open again and having sports fans pack it.
In today's day and age, in the climate where everybody is so divided on every little thing, the one thing that people get together on is sports. You know, I think about it all the time when I go to Staples Center and I'm sitting there with 18,000 people, and I know half the people in there might not agree with how I feel politically, or I might not agree with them or whatever. None of that matters. None of that matters. We're watching sports. We have a common bond. And that's what I miss in the restaurant.
That's Steve Cohen of West Hills Pizza Company. Steve, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, and good luck.
It's definitely not business as usual for schools either, but while there are very few public school districts operating as normal right now, there is no other school superintendent in Los Angeles County who has quite the same pandemic authority as LA Unified's Austin Buettner. Back in March, the school board gave him emergency powers to make fast-track business deals to respond to COVID-19, and Buettner still has these powers 7 months later. So, how has he used them? KPCC's Kyle Stokes went out and got the records and is here with some answers. Kyle, when we say no superintendent in LA County has the same powers as Buettner, what does that mean? Hello, Kyle, are you there? All right, we're going to get to Kyle Stokes coming up in just a bit. Breaking news from a few minutes ago, the president has been dealing with a fever all morning long since he announced last night that he and his wife Melania tested positive for COVID-19. Marine One helicopter is now on the White House lawn, and they are about to take the president to Walter Reed Medical Center. So we're going to have more on this story as it continues to unfold right here on 89.3 KPC. All right, let's go back now to Kyle Stokes. Kyle, I was asking you about how when we say that no superintendent in LA County has the same powers as Austin Buettner, what does that mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So LAUSD's school board gave Austin Buettner these powers under a state law that allows for school superintendents in the time of emergency to approve contracts and purchases, first of all, without a school board vote, which you would normally need, and also while skipping the normal vetting process for these contracts and purchases. And that is a big deal because that vetting process in LAUSD's case can take something like 4 or 5 months. So I checked with the LA County regulators who keep track of this kind of thing. I assumed a lot of local districts must be using this state law, but no, LAUSD is the only district that's given its superintendent this kind of power to spend on pandemic response.
So just how much has districts spent using these emergency powers, and what has he spent it on?
Yeah, so we have the records from mid-March to early September, and they show us that LAUSD is reporting spending more than $210 million under these emergency powers. Now, in normal times, that's basically what LAUSD spends in a week. The district does have a really big budget. Still, that $210 million has paid for some programs that have generated a lot of praise for the district, in particular, the COVID-19 testing program. There's also personal protective gear, meal distribution. And then right at the beginning of the pandemic, $70 million for laptops and internet devices for needy students. And those are all programs that Superintendent Buettner says are critical.
So why did LAUSD decide these were the kind of powers that Superintendent Buettner needed?
Yeah, well, so I'll answer that with an example that Austin Buettner gave to me. And this is how he says the device program, the computer and internet device program, came to be. Remember back in March, I mean, every school in the world basically needed more laptops. And LAUSD staff, they had this moment when they realized they needed to act faster. And Buettner says one galvanizing moment happened while the district staff were on the phone with Apple looking for iPads.
We were at a point with them where they said, here it is. We have this much inventory left in all of the U.S., and it's at our stores. You want it or not?
And right there, that illustrates why LAUSD's board granted those powers. And there just wasn't time for the normal 4 to 5 month process to get those devices. And in fact, during those phone calls with Apple, what Buettner says happened is actually the school board, they were just a few hours away from voting on the emergency powers at the time. So it's kind of a crazy story. The superintendent says the district's answer to Apple was basically an unofficial verbal over the phone. Yeah, we'll take the iPads. And then when the board approved the emergency powers just a few hours later, that's when the district actually signed the paperwork. That is just how fast things were moving.
One last thing, Kyle, because like in most school districts, it's LAUSD's board, not the superintendent. It doesn't belong to Austin Buettner, and that normally means that they have the final say in all spending decisions. Is the school board inclined to let Buettner continue to have these powers?
I think yes, for the most part. They do see Buettner as having done a lot of good with these emergency powers, setting up the programs that we've mentioned. Board member Monica Garcia, one who's explicitly supportive, saying we're still in a crisis. On the other hand, I do think there are a few board members who are also wondering how much longer the district can stay in this mode. It has been nearly 7 months, after all. Board member Scott Schmerlson told me he favored modifying the powers. And then I also spoke with school board member Kelly Gonis.
We can't continue as we are in perpetuity. We should have a real conversation about, you know, the appropriateness of it moving forward. But I do want to be thoughtful about that, because our gold star is obviously, how will students be impacted?
Right there, you can hear the balancing act.
Yeah, yeah.
Board members are the highest officials. They, the buck stops with them. They want to oversee spending, but the superintendent, they see that he's doing good work and it's helping kids. So how do you balance that?
With great power comes great responsibility. That was the line in the Spider-Man movie, right? KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, it's one of the worst things a pregnant woman can go through, and also one of the hardest to talk about. When model and TV personality Chrissy Teigen shared on social media that she suffered a miscarriage, she opened the door to a conversation that some women may feel too devastated or ashamed to be a part of. Coming up, we'll hear how to navigate the grieving process of miscarriages. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
Feet, a flower bud in concrete, feeling so incomplete. Wonder will we ever meet? And would you know it right away? How hard I try to see your face. A little screen, a photograph, mine to take. I sit and I stare at your clothes in the drawer. I cry and my knuckles get sore. 'Cause I still believe it won't be like before. Now somehow I just want.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. Pregnancy loss is almost a taboo subject in our society, but this week, model Chrissy Teigen and her husband, John Legend, shared that they suffered a miscarriage, losing the son that they had named Jack. Teigen wrote on social media, quote, "We are shocked and in the kind of deep pain you only hear about, the kind of pain we've never felt before." Helping families to grieve miscarriages is at the heart of what Dr. Janet Joffe does as co-founder of the Center for Reproductive Psychology.
Miscarriages are way more common than we think. So we figure that there's about 25% of pregnancies fail. But that number is probably a low estimate. As women age, the number goes way up. And so when someone is in their late 30s or early 40s, it can be as high as 75% of pregnancies that fail.
So, Dr. Dillon, what sorts of thoughts and feelings do women experience when a miscarriage happens?
I think that one of the very basic assumptions that women have is that it's part of being female, and that we will have the ability to get pregnant easily and then carry a baby to full term and have a wonderful, healthy baby. And so when it doesn't happen, there's a real disintegration of basic core beliefs. It's as if the rug has been pulled out The pieces are flying in the air, and they haven't landed yet. It's a really disorienting kind of experience. So you've got sort of two things happening at the same time. You've got this sense of grieving a very significant loss, which other people may not see as significant, and you've got this sense of self, of feeling damaged, responsible, helpless. Like, there's nothing that one can do, but there's a feeling like, I should have. There's so many times that women think about, well, what if I didn't carry that bag of groceries? What if I didn't, wash the floor? What if I didn't, whatever activity it might be, that feeling of needing to find something to blame. Because if you can find a reason, then next time you won't do that. But all of that is a myth.
And while, I'm sure it might be in the back of a woman's mind when they are pregnant, when they start this journey, I mean, no one anticipates complications. I don't know if anyone thinks that that could be something down the road that I'm expecting. I think people maybe want to naturally think that my pregnancy is going to be just great.
Exactly.
And then we've got social media where people are posting pictures of every single step of a journey. When we've got all of that surrounding, say, someone who is dealing with a miscarriage, how does that factor into the emotions that a woman feels?
Well, she can feel enormously depressed, feel like that she doesn't fit in anywhere. When friends and family don't respond, with the Center of Reproductive Psychology, we've coined this term reproductive story. And, there may be worries about pregnancy and pregnancy loss, but basically our story is, this is going to happen and it's going to be great. And so when it doesn't happen, when a trauma occurs instead, when death occurs instead of life, it is a devastating loss. Just devastating.
We're talking to Dr. Janet Jaffe. She is the co-founder of the Center for Reproductive Psychology. So on that note, doctor, when you see a story like the one Chrissy Teigen shared on social media this week, what can that do for women and for society in general in terms of understanding miscarriages?
I think having anyone be able to talk openly the way she did about her experience can bring a sense of validity to other women's experiences. And, each pregnancy loss is unique in itself. It sounds like what Chrissy Teigen went through was just excruciating. And not only was there emotional trauma, but medical trauma as well. And I think for every woman, knowing that it's safe, that you really can and should talk about it, and should talk about it to people who are safe. She's unique in that she sort of broadcast it, but I think that being able to talk through feelings with people who understand and get it is really, really helpful.
Chrissy Teigen, doctor, has been criticized in the past for maybe oversharing a lot of stuff on social media. But how does what she did this week help maybe chip away at the stigma that a woman might feel?
This is oftentimes called the silent loss because people just don't talk about it. Women have been, sort of pressured to put it aside and let's pretend that this isn't a significant loss. And so what that does on a psychological level is, you may be feeling something so intensely, but yet being told not to talk about it. And so with being open about it and open about the intensity of the pain and the loss, I think it gives women permission to say, wow, my feelings are real. This is not just made up. And I'm not going crazy. I think that's a really important part of this, because really one of the things that women really want is to just say, I'm so sorry for your loss, and to have that be acknowledged as a real event. It's the biggest event in one's life.
Doctor, if a woman's partner happens to be the father of the baby, how does the miscarriage affect that person?
That's a great question. I think men can feel enormously helpless. Classically, what do men want to do? They want to fix things. They want to, make it better. They want to be the coach that can tell you how to get through something. And this is something that not only can they not fix, but they're having feelings as well. and it's an enormous loss for men. If women are not allowed to talk about it, men are really not allowed to talk about it. So that can be pretty awful.
So, okay, if you're a friend or a family member and you want to say something to console the couple who has a miscarriage, I mean, where do you start, doctor? And maybe what should you avoid?
So as I said, I think the thing I can't emphasize it enough, is to just listen and let the grieving parents know that you validate what they're going through, what you shouldn't say. There's a whole list. I can give you a few examples, but don't say, it was for the best. This was not for the best. Even if there was something, many, many miscarriages happen because there's something wrong with the baby, but it's not for the best. Don't say, don't worry about it, you can have another. That means that you can just replace one child with another. And the attachment that parents feel to their unborn child, it starts immediately. It may start even before they're pregnant. That feeling of, this is going to be our family, that feeling of the future, that feeling of connection. And so there's no way that you can replace one child with another.
Okay, so that's what families and friends should say and avoid. What about the women who have had the miscarriages? What can they say to themselves to get out somehow of the blame, of the self-blame and the guilt that they might be feeling about it?
Yes, that's a really hard thing, because having nothing to blame, nothing to say this is what the cause of this was, is sometimes harder than having it be sort of a random thing that happens. And so holding on to, again, as I said, did I lift a heavy bag of groceries? Holding on to something like that can actually, in a weird way, make people feel better, because then they can say, I've had some control of this. But really, most of the time, there is no reason. There is no, there may be medical reasons, but there's nothing that a woman actually did.
That's Dr. Janet Jaffe, co-founder for the Center for Reproductive Psychology. Doctor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we have an update on President Trump being taken to Walter Reed Medical Center. He's been dealing with a fever all morning and afternoon long after announcing yesterday that he and the First Lady Melania Trump tested positive for COVID-19. He will be spending the next few days now at Walter Reed Medical Center, but the White House says there will not be a transfer of power, that the president will be working from the presidential offices at Walter Reed. We're going to have a lot more on this breaking story as it develops. We're going to go to All Things Considered today, right after Take Two, right at 3 o'clock. More Take Two coming up in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and most places where you get your podcasts. I'm Amy Martinez. It is officially October, which means spooky season is upon us. And even though Halloween is not canceled this year, it will be very different, since the usual carnivals, haunted houses, festivals, and parties are prohibited. You might remember how LA County health officials initially banned trick-or-treating. Well, that order has been amended, but while it's not forbidden, it's also not recommended. So what can we do to celebrate the holiday? KPCC's Itzy Quintanilla has been looking into that. Now, Itzy, the new rules make sense, but with no haunted houses and no trick-or-treating, wondering, what does the county say would be a safe thing to do?
Well, the county has also laid out some recommended activities. Those include things like car parades that comply with public health guidelines, drive-in theaters or drive-through events where people stay in their cars, Halloween-themed outdoor museums or art installations, and of course, virtual events.
Now, I know you've been searching around to find events that that people can do to celebrate Halloween while staying safe, which for me would be staying like in a corner of my room with the covers over me because I'm so afraid of going outside. But for others, it would mean staying in their car. So what kind of things have you found?
Well, there are a number of options around LA and Orange County. Now, these are not inexpensive thrills, but they could be considered someone's big Halloween splurge. First up, Griffith Park's Haunted Hayride has been transformed to a drive-up experience this year. It's relocated to San Dimas in the San Gabriel Valley, and it'll feature a multimedia show accompanied by real-life characters and scary sets. Tickets for that start at $49.99 per vehicle with up to two people in the car. Next, there's Knights of Jack in Calabasas. This is a drive-through Halloween experience that features thousands of hand-carved and illuminated jack-o'-lanterns, according to their website. Now, if you're looking for a spookier experience, there's the Urban Legends Haunt in Orange County. It's also a drive-thru, but this one includes immersive storytelling featuring live performances and special effects. Here's a sneak peek into what it sounds like. All ages are welcome, but they recommend the experience for people 13 and older, and tickets for that start at $59.99 per car. I'd also suggest heading over to each website to find out more about their COVID-19 safety protocols.
Absolutely. You always want to do that. Now, clearly, it's no shortage of drive-through experiences. What other kinds of events are happening that comply with Los Angeles County health guidelines?
Well, staying on the car theme, there's a couple of drive-ins that will be featuring scary movies this month, including the San Fernando Valley Halloween drive-in at the Westfield Fashion Square in Sherman Oaks. The screenings start October 16th with a double feature of Edward Scissorhands and Pet Sematary. And if you want to get out of your car, Descanso Gardens in La Quiñada is hosting what they call a pumpkin-filled extravaganza. That's going to feature a hay maze, scarecrows, socially distanced, of course. I spoke with Jennifer Errico with Descanso Gardens, and she explains what you can expect.
We finished our pumpkin house, which is a house that's out on our main lawn. It's surrounded by a hay maze, and it's completely covered in pumpkins. And then today, they are finishing off our, I'm calling it the Pond Monster, which is this huge monster made of pumpkins that will rise out of one of our local ponds.
She says that members get free admission, and non-member tickets are from $4 to $15. And tickets are very limited to avoid crowds.
All right, that's KPCC's Itzi Quintanilla. Thank you very much for the spooky ideas.
Of course. Thanks, A.
All right, then, for what else to do this weekend that's less spooky, we can help you out.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran, and A. Martinez, did you know that weeks can end? Because it felt like the one we're going through is going on forever. So if you're getting a few days to get away from it all, we've got ideas to help you self-care and get your mind off of things.
All right, give it to me. What's first on the list?
Live performances. Some of you might have missed going out to see a band or comedian. Well, the mid-city venue, The Mint, has figured out how to still do that on the street. Today and tomorrow night, they're hosting sidewalk sessions. This is where patrons and performers are outside on the sidewalk. Acts include Elise Carver and Illunis, and food and beverage service will be available too. And even though we're in a heat wave, I actually have to say, I was out last night at an outdoor venue and the weather was marvelous.
Ooh, nice.
So you can actually really enjoy it once the sun goes down. And when you go, this one is free to sit down, but of course, you know, food, drink, whatever, that's not free.
All right. Now, not only that, there are more outdoor performances to enjoy.
Yeah, and this one is about dance. Now through the 10th, the Heidi Duckler Dance Company presents The Quest. This is a series of site-specific dance performances presented throughout the city in places like Watts and the Vendome Museum in Culver City. Tonight's takes place at the Baldwin Hills Scenic Overlook. All performances are either drive-up or walk-up, and masks are required, but this is a great way to see some performances that you might have missed in the past several months. They all start all around sundown, and tickets start at $35.
All right, finally, Leo, what's one last event we can do outside?
It's a drive-in concert. Tomorrow at the Rubidoux Drive-In in Riverside, they host two concerts in your car. First is Yachtly Crew, that's known for their 70s and 80s throwback rock. Then later in the night, Metalachi, which is obviously a mix of metal and mariachi. So this is a really great way to relive the crowded, loud concert experience without the crowds pressing against you. And when you want to go to either concert, tickets start at $79. Now, there are still a bunch more events to go to, whether you're outside or still on your couch. Find out what you can do this weekend by heading to our site, laist.com. That's LAIST.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Leo Has a Cat.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, just to update you on the breaking news, President Trump will be spending the next few days at Walter Reed Medical Center. We'll have more on this story on All Things Considered coming up in just a few minutes. More Take Two on Monday. See you later.